Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thunder, Felix, and welcome to the 2080 Thrillcast. I am your host, Mulcha, and we continue our coverage of the San Diego Comic-Con panels from this year. Hope you enjoyed last week's 2080 Thrill Hour. This week we have the Treasury of British Comics panel, which was hosted by myself with guests Rosie Knight from The Nerdist, Ben Smith, who's the head of books and comic books at 2000 AD, Zach Davidson, who's a manga translator from the States, and journalist Graham McMillan, who works for The Hollywood Reporter. One of the great things about the makeup of this panel is that we have different experiences of the books that have been coming out from the Treasury of British Comics, which celebrated its first birthday earlier this year. From people like Rosie, Graham, myself, who grew up with classic British comics such as Wizard and Chips and Roy the Rovers and 2000 AD and Battle and Action and all the others, to somebody like Zach, whose first experience was me sending him a bunch of PDFs. But it's absolutely fascinating to see people's different approach, people's different experience, and also to see how we came together to really broadcast our love of classic British comics. Audience were fantastic, very appreciative of what we were trying to do, and yeah, it's a fascinating 45 minutes or so. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the second of our panels from San Diego Comic-Con.
Welcome to the Treasury of British Comics panel, the first one ever at San Diego. How many people have been interested in British comics?
It's always
a slight fear that people are just here because this room is quite far away and quiet and a bit against the street.
Want to learn something.
Oh, good, excellent. Well, this is final for you. We're missing Zach Davidson, unfortunately, but hopefully he'll turn up in a few minutes. Introduce myself. My name is Mike Mulcher. I handle the publicity for 2000 AD and also the Treasury of British Comics. Joined on this panel by journalist Rosie Knight. Do you want to give a round of applause? By the head of books and comic books at Rebellion Publishing, Ben Smith.
Hello.
And from the Hollywood Reporter, we have Graham McMillan. So, this panel is all about British comics. Now, to give some context for why Treasury of British Comics exists and why we're talking about British comics, last 2 years ago, the publishers of 2000 Rebellion purchased the archive from IPC Fleetway, which was one of the big two publishers in British comics in the 1970s and 80s. You had IPC Fleetway and you had DC Thompson. For those of you who know Dennis the Menace and Beano and Dan...
The other Dennis the Menace. The real Dennis.
Yeah, not your Dennis.
Not the one.
The British had the big two as well as the main big two. And 2018 was an old IPC Fleetway title. We brought the majority of the archive of Fleetway IPC into the 2018 archives, and we have been steadily beginning to reprint some of these classic forgotten comics, some which have never been reprinted before. We all grew up with these, so we're very aware. Hopefully over the next sort of 45 minutes or so, we're going to not only infect you with a passion for classic British comics, but also explore a little bit about the lessons that perhaps mainstream comics today can learn from old school British comics, both in terms of their format and their editorial outlook. First off, I want to turn to Ben to talk just a little bit about the archive. Mm-hmm. And number one, how we came to kind of reunite 2000 AD with its old stablemates, but also what our plans were when we began to look at what we would reprint.
So to reel back a bit, Rebellion is the parent company of 2008 and the Treasury, has been the publisher of 2008 since the year 2000, which is really convenient, which makes it, we've been publishing it for 18 years, which makes us that comic's longest publisher by far and away. That comic was the last one left out of this glorious, vast dozens and dozens of weekly comics and monthly comics, girls comics, boys comics, adventure comics, war comics, sports comics, comics for everybody, literally, and it was a matter of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I think you've just been joined by Zach.
Oh, that's right. I didn't realize how far away this
was. Yes, we are in the far back corner right. of Comic-Con.
I'm looking at him like, really? Whoa, I'm going to be late.
Sorry to my friend, but just to introduce Zach
Dayton,
who is a translator.
Yeah, I'm a writer and translator. I do a lot of manga translation. That's my primary job. So I translate, I don't know, if anyone here reads manga, I translate the comic Devilman, which has been a little bit of a hit recently. So,
that's the best reaction we've had so far.
Right? I know, and I've languished in obscurity forever, and all of a sudden Network put out this TV show, Devilman Crybaby, that I had nothing to do with, but the reflected glory on the comic suddenly made a big name, so I'm like, yeah. Right, exactly.
But I'm via David Brothers, formerly of Image, I invited Zach onto the panel because it'd be interesting to get an outsider's perspective on the British comics that we're talking about, and also whether there's any kind of synergy between what manga does and what British comics do.
Yeah, and I was super excited because I've been a fan of British comics for ever, you know, so yeah, it was like, oh, I gotta be on a British comics panel? That's gonna be my one chance of all of my life. Do you need me to talk about Judge Dredd or anything?
Brilliant. So let's.
So we're in the 90s, yeah. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of comics, and the owners of the company at the time had only acquired it because they also had the license to print Disney comics. Which is what that company did in the rest of Europe. And so over the course of 8 years, they went from dozens and dozens of comics to 2008 in the Judge Dredd magazine, and all of the others were basically just wiped out. And then we bought 2008, saved it, put it back to number one on the newsstand, best-selling graphic novels, launched in America, all very successful, movies, yada, yada, yada. meanwhile, they'd done nothing with all of these pages of comics, from all of these dozens of other comics. And it was on a plane to San Diego 8 years ago that Pat Mills, who's the founding editor of 2008 and a British comics legend, started talking to me about Misty, which is the great lost girls comic, the great girls horror comic. And now I've got to apologise because I'll talk about girls comics and boys comics and things like that, and that's just the language that we used at the time. That was very much how things were sold. Girls would lend their comics to their brothers and their brothers would lend their comics to the girls, but that was the way things were sold back then. But anyway, so Pat started talking to me about Misty, this supernatural horror comic, exclusively targeted girls, and that sounded really interesting. And why is that not available? And why had I never heard of it? Because I didn't have a sister. So we looked into acquiring that under license from Egmont, and I certainly discovered that the people who were running the archive there just hated running the archive because they wanted to be doing Star Wars licensing and Disney licensing, and the last thing they wanted to do was take care of this vast treasure trove of amazing British comics that they weren't really interested in. So I made them an offer, and then we negotiated for 18 months and they revised my offers and then we picked it up. And so what we did was the ambition was to publish a graphic novel every single month from this lost archive. And when I say lost archive, to give you a scale of it, I had to install 90 linear meters of shelving to put in red bound volumes which had single issue copies of all the comics. So we calculated that as about 600,000 pages of comic strip, most of which, the vast majority of which, has not been seen since the week it was first published. So that's been amazing. So we've done, I think we have 15 books now that we've done, and we've started selling. And the thing about it is, there was no conversation about British comics. If you're a British comics fan, you would know more about the history of American comics than you would about the history of British comics. And I do this for a living, and I've spent the past 2 years going, oh, really? And so part of, you know, what we'd like to see so many faces here actually is that this whole understanding of what the history of British comics is and the depth and richness to it all is amazing, which is why our Treasury of British Comics list is quite as eclectic as it is. And we've got nature comics and horror comics and orphan ballerinas. Oh, sorry, orphan gymnasts. We'll get to ballerinas later. And war comics and Beatles biographies and all manner of stuff. So yeah, so that's kind of how it started and kicked off.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about the archive is what Michael Carroll, for those of you who don't know, Michael Carroll is a writer who works for 2000 AD, writes for Australia, but also he's fascinated by the history of British comics, and he's done these amazing kind of family trees, because all these comics are connected, because they were folded into one another. There was this tradition of hatch, match and dispatch. So you would launch a title, see if it did well. If it didn't, you would merge it into another title that needed a boost and hope that the audience from the title you were cancelling merged over. So that's happened a couple of times in 2008's history with Star-Lord and Tornado. But you get these incredible family trees of comics that have been strong enough to be merged with lots of other titles and then have weakened so they've been merged with something else. And it's an absolutely incredible way of looking at it. And I mean, it's incredibly incestuous as well, the way you get the same people working on stuff. But Rosie, I want to talk to you for a moment about British comics. As Ben has alluded, when these comics were being published, there was very much a girls' comics and boys' comics thing. But within that, there was an incredible breadth of genres. You know, it wasn't the girls' comics are everyone goes for a nice picnic and you know, likes flowers.
Yeah.
What was your experience?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with recognising marketplaces. And I don't think, even though I think every comic could be enjoyable by anyone of any gender, it's actually, like, in a way, the way Western comics are now is very progressive. And actually, there was something more progressive about having people saying, oh, look, women are an audience for comics. Like, that's the thing I love the most about the archive. And the comics, like, especially Misty, is, you know, just the most exciting thing ever. And having these comics having proof that women have always been a market for comics, or girls, because that's, like, this modern myth, especially post the 80s and Watchmen, Dark Knight and stuff, which were these seminal comics, but they were very masculine, and they really changed the marketplace and who was seen as an audience for comics. It's quite radical to have this proof of, oh, look, this is, you know, this was how comics were. It was the same in American comics. You know, you have the monster comics from Marvel and you have the romance comics. Like, there were these two defined brands, and I feel like not having that actually gives companies an excuse to not make comics for a wide audience. So in a way, I think there's actually something quite special about that, even if the idea of having to separate comics by gender seems regressive, at least you're recognising that more than one gender enjoys comics.
Well, I think that's really interesting, because obviously we looked at the circulation figures that we have for all of the comics, and the girls' comics outsold the boys' comics, hands down. They were far more popular. And that kind of is a very good... You can see that replicated now, because girls' comics, if you want to call them that way, actually are now sold in the YA and the middle grade sections of the bookstores, not on the graphic novel shelves. And they're huge, because Raina Telmeyer has a print run of 500,000. You know, the Walking Dead, God love it, but it sells, what, 100,000 a month?
Even things like Marvel, they had always, their big drive sort of every decade was find another street level superhero like Spider-Man, right? And they could never do it. And it was because Spider-Man was this, you know, caught lightning in a bottle, blah. And then G. Willow Wilson and Adolfo, they made Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan, and it was the first Marvel book that wasn't a licensed property like Star Wars or something that had gone to 7 printings on its first issue. Like, these books, there is always that audience, like you say, you know, and for a really long time, it was like one of the, and you know, it's hard to keep a direct market book selling, but there are these audiences that are there, and I think that the archives, and especially because, like, you have books that are also about, like, nature, and, you know, a whole book that's just cartoon strips about foxes. Anyone can enjoy that! Like, that's amazing! And especially when you look at what's popular in webcomics now, there is so much kind of unique storytelling that comes from this other place where it is all about animals or forests and nature, and it's people trying to tell stories through a different medium. And I think the archive really taps into that.
Well, and I was going to add also, like, speaking of boys and girls comics, like, Japan unabashedly does that. Not even, and they even segment it more. They have comics for young girls, comics for older girls, you know, comics for young boys, comics for old men, you know. I mean, like they are very gender split. Like, when you go into a bookstore, they're split along that way. You'll have, like, you know, story one is all the girls' comics, and then you go up to the second story, and that's all the boys' comics. And they sell immensely more comics than we do, you know. By trying to play the this comic should suit the needs of 100% of everyone game that a lot of American comic companies do, that's like, here's a comic, it should be enjoyed by everyone of all ages and all genders and all things. You try to hit this giant wide target, but I think it diffuses the audience more than companies who sell super targeted comics, you know. And it also opens up the market, like Japan has an immense number of female comic creators. Every time I see a panel or something in America, they're like, let's get around and talk about women comic creators. You know, Kelly Sue DeConnick, G. Willow Wilson. I'm like, yes, absolutely. Can we also, in that same sentence, discuss Rumiko Takahashi?
Thank you.
You know, the wealthiest woman in Japan, who is an absolute national institution and who has gotten that way by writing comic books.
Who might also finally get put in the Eisner Hall of Fame after a million years.
The fact that we still have to vote for her is,
I know.
Just,
it was like Jeffy Orms, who was she's like one of the most popular syndicated cartoonists of all time, a black woman in the 40s and 50s, and she did a strip called Torchy Brown. She only got put in this year because last year she didn't get voted in.
Yeah.
And I was so furious. But you're right, there's such a wider breadth of people who make and read comics. Them.
And I recognize, like, I thought it was funny because my favorite one, the ones they sent me, was definitely Bella of the Bar, the orphan gymnast, because it reminded me so much of one of my favorite Japanese comics called Yuwara-chan, the fashionable judo girl. And it was just like, it was just a ridiculous comic. It's so good, but it's just so bizarre.
I think you're right. Like, when I was looking through this and I was thinking about, like, having, like, Misty and then having, like, the war comics, or even if you think about it, like, with having Misty and having something like 2000 AD or something, it is like Shonen and Shoujo.
Right,
exactly. It's this idea of targeting your stories and also telling, like, who's writing a comic nowadays about a ballerina? Oh, actually, Tilly Walden is. She's amazing. You should read it. It's an autobiographical comic from first second, but they're a book publisher.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
No one's making newsprint comics or weekly comics about someone who's a girl, young girl doing ballet, or like a young, you know, or a fox exploring a forest. It's all very consumed by superheroes, and if you talk about like who are comics targeted to, even if comic like Marvel or DC says, oh, we're targeting it for everyone, they're not. They're targeting for a very small, specific market that they see as profitable, which is changing, but.
But exactly, I think that you know, that is exactly what this archive can teach modern comics. Within the girls' comics, there were exactly what you were talking about. There were juvenile kind of teen girls' comics, which also have some other content in as well. And then there was pure comics for girls as well. But there were different types of girls' comics. So there was, and this is separate entirely to romance comics, which were another genre completely, and for largely for women.
There weren't.
It's very frustrating in modern comics too when you have people like that. We need to make a comic for girls. Romance. I mean, it's like they're stuck in that one genre. But same with Japan. You've got these wonderful girls' horror comics. You've got these wonderful girls' action series. I mean, you've got Sailor Moon, right? I mean, you've got like just all this great stuff. One of my favorite things, I don't know if you've ever seen this, like everyone knows Sailor Moon, right? Do you ever see her original design concept? It's one of my favorite pieces of art on earth, because Sailor Moon was originally packing heat. She didn't have magical swords or anything. It's Sailor Moon with just these awesome, super realistic drawn guns. Yeah, the power of love and friendship came after.
Graham, we've not heard from you. I mean, what's your take on the archive and the way that British comics used to be?
When you look at what web comics are now, the British comics of their day were that very thing 40 years ago. It was all there. The market has already existed and been there. And then it vanished because of market forces or because the owners were not interested in
computer games. Yeah, I don't even, you know, everybody said, oh, it's because, you know, computer games became popular in the 90s. And there are lots of bunch of excuses, and it was all, genuinely, but what you might have lost.
Games became popular.
Yeah, exactly, but you also might have
published Sonic.
Yeah, well, that's true. But again, it was shaving down the audience. I mean, interestingly, girls comics did die off in the 80s rather than the 90s. All comics kind of were ended in the 90s in Britain.
Yeah.
But in the 80s, girls comics ended, actually, weirdly enough, as the preconception was that they had to be teen magazines, and so they kind of the teen comics transmogrified into teen magazines, and then the juvenile comics got left behind.
But it's so funny talking about boys' comics and girls' comics because I bought Misty.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. You know, I remember reading Bunty, and it wasn't because my sisters were reading Bunty. I liked the stories.
Yeah,
I read Josie and the Pussycats. I mean, you know, yeah.
Exactly.
Simultaneously reading Marvel UK's Transformers title, I was reading my sister's Marvel UK Care Bears title as well, which is brilliant. If you ever get a chance to check out Marvel UK Care Bears, I know it's a different company, but it was...
those UK books are so wild, though.
This is kind of what I want to come into. One of the aspects that we were talking about yesterday, Graham, was the class consciousness. Mm-hmm. In old school British comics, and
that girls' comics. The girls' comics are all class war comics.
Oh my God! Well, I've been talking about Bella at the Bar. It is a class. I mean, it's essentially Billy Elliot.
I thought of that instantly when I first saw it. I'm like, oh hey, Billy Elliot, but much earlier.
Working class girl who lives with an incredibly abusive uncle and aunt. And dreams of being
a gymnast.
And by abusive, we're talking on a Dickensian level, right? Like, she's actually in one chat, like physically chained to a table, and like it was just.
What's incredible about these comics? They are so intense. They're like in Wes girl comics, and they are. I mean, what's the Jinty comic that we were talking about last?
Oh, well, I love Tears.
Yeah. I have it in my phone.
Jinty was incredible.
It's almost offensive. I can't believe you're going to republish it now. Yeah.
But once again, Jinty would be fine in the DC Vertigo line. Like, you would see that there right now, and you'd be like, it fits. You know?
Completely. There's all
these things. Jinty is it was a mixed genre.
So it was effectively an adventure
comic. Sci-fi as well, so we've created The Land of No Tears and Human Zoo, which are in terms of premise, a fairly straightforward, kind of slightly dystopian sci-fi with a moral twist. But they put the characters in the absolute ringer. You know, it's really kind of hard stuff. And there are some interesting choices of words.
A lot of this stuff is of the time, and so we do have trigger warnings and things like that when we put the collections together, because some of it is retrograde and doesn't stand the test of time.
But some of it is even better because of that. Yeah, exactly. Again, you have audiences now, or you have creators now, publishers now, who shy away from what they expect the audience wants.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at something like Land of No Tears, it's amazing. You can't imagine a publisher now saying, we're going to do a science fiction story aimed at girls, but it's going to be this class war tale that involves...
Well, they're also incredibly visceral. I mean, what I find amazing about the 70s girls comics, and I should just say, by the way, that the 2008 app or the 2008 website has free preview pages of all of these books in the Treasury of British Comics app, so you can go away and just look online and you can see samples of what we're talking about, what we haven't done on the stand downstairs. But the girls' comic stories were emotionally so much more advanced than Wham! Biff! Pow!, which was a lot of what some of the boys' comics were doing. And the revolution that 2000 AD brought about in comic storytelling was because all of the writers on 2000 AD had spent the 5 years preceding it writing girls' comics.
Yeah.
And doing some other things as well. But they'd all grounded themselves in the emotional honesty of those comics. And what's fascinating to me about the violence, because whereas boys can have the release of ultra violence, as it were, in some of their comics, in the girls' comics, there is violence, but it's very, very, very sparse. And when it happens, it is far more like you sit back from the page and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that's just happened.
Also, though, I think it's like the sad thing about a lot of stuff when it comes to like stuff like Land of No Tears, which when I was looking at it, I was just like, how is this not? This is the kind of thing that you would expect to have like an artist's edition, hardcover. Every guy who writes about comics is writing about it and stuff. And
why is there not a fandom based around this. This is one of the most amazing things that I've read.
Yeah. And it's very, like, Moebius-y. Like, it's very, like, weird sci-fi. Like, you know, nobody else is Moebius, but there's sometimes when stuff is aimed at women, it is seen as lesser. Mm-hmm. And that historically has been the way. And I think that means a lot of people actually lose the chance to enjoy it. Because, like I'm saying, you bought Misty, you read these things because you found them. But in society, people are told, oh, this is like a girl's story. It's probably boring, or it's about this, or it's about that. And you have this archive that just completely contradicts that. But also, as well, like the class thing is really interesting because I think that is so intrinsic in British storytelling. So even like you mentioned earlier, like Kes, you know, there's all these iconic stories in Britain that are about class and are about class struggle or about just like living and being poor. And I feel like that is not necessarily something that is explored as much in American comics, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting too.
That's because in America we have no class.
Funny enough, I was having a conversation with someone earlier today about this, and they said, we don't have class in America, we have race.
Yeah.
And from a business perspective, looking at a lot of the struggles in America, it feels very much like a different way of expressing class and of economic concerns. So it's the same woes, the same problems expressed in a different way.
It's the reflection where it's like in Britain there's a really obvious class structure and that lessens the conversations around race because people will be like working class and it's one thing but no one thinks about what it's like for like black working class people or whatever. Whereas here it's focused on the race so no one talks about poverty or like, so it's this weird kind of reflection of like broad terms. But I have been pretty shocked by the lack of a general conversation when you talk about like people always say to me like, oh, there's no working class in America. And I'm like, well, there is. But you just don't call it that, you know, and I think these stories are such a interesting thing of like what kids' stories, like even if you think of like a mainstream comic, please put up your hand if you can think of one because I'm not trying to be like derivative to them, but like I can't think of like a superhero story that's like aimed at kids that's about like class.
But when you talk about class as well, I think what we are talking also about poverty. And these comics were also there were a handful of pence. There were 4, 5, 6, 7 pence.
Yeah, they're accessible.
And they were, we're not talking about class struggles in the sense in these stories that where it's behavioural that the kid is behaving wrong and therefore is not going on. It is about. Poor people without money. You know, some of these characters are just very, very, and it's not, that's not what they're about. But their background is they're coming basically close to the gutter, or as Bella doesn't ever seem to go to school. She's cleaning windows for her uncle, and she goodness knows where she's been exposed to gymnastics, but she's a natural talent, and she just has to try and find ways to get through to it. But she's literally it's not bread. It's kind of close to the poverty line.
Yeah.
But that was just. But that's where she's starting, and then things are.
Yeah, it's not a explicitly, explicitly a story about class, but it is implicitly a story.
Yeah. And I think as well, like that is like we're talking about what things people can learn. Like some of the best comics in the world, like say Jack Kirby or something. He was someone who did like Ben Grimm. He's from Yancey Street. He's like reflecting this kind of poor, very specific like New York American upbringing. So there's like pinches of it, but it's less political or explorative because I don't think those stories aren't told as much as they're in Britain. But in modern comics, like I think the third arc of Miss Marvel, to bring it up again, they did like a gentrification storyline. And when I was looking through this stuff, I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of what British comics for girls were doing back then, where they're looking at kind of, they're building a story that's exciting and fun, and it's not about superheroes, it's about a gymnast, or it's about sci-fi, but they're built on these kind of real world things. And it seems like now a few writers, once you diversify the writing pool, are starting to do that too.
So it's always weird to hear any, and we do get this, when 2008 does its satirical thing, we get people telling us, well, take the politics out of comics. What comics have you been reading?
I love that conversation. Yeah. Take the politics out of comics. Like it's so funny because you said that. Like, there's not that many American comics about class per se, but there's an immense number about race,
obviously.
You know, and even then, when you think about it, like the original Superman comic, he was a blue class working working class hero who punched out the tycoons, right? That was his whole
gig. And he was an immigrant.
Yeah.
You know, so it's those things, those stories are always intrinsic. The first, you know, Captain America, first issue, front page, he's punching Hitler. That's very political because these stories are, every story is political. Everything, you can't have an apolitical story. And 2008 is a great example of that because people will be like,
I'd like a non-political Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
I would like to see what does that look like.
I would say that.
Literally, what does that look like? I can't imagine it.
When the they did recently, and it's a little bit off topic, kind of not talking about girls' comics and stuff. You guys did the sci-fi special with all female creators, right? It's really good. And a bunch of guys, like, when I was tweeting about it, I did some articles, they'll be like, this is like some SJW bullshit. Like, you need to take the politics out of 2008.
Is that your American accent?
No, it was just the accent.
Is that your American accent, love? Is that what we just heard?
It was just my internet man accent, I guess. But it was like, have you ever read, like, you know, Judge Dredd isn't like, and I'm doing another panel about satire and Judge Dredd with Moltres.
I always thought Judge Dredd was Britain's commentary on America.
Yeah, it is.
That's what I think that it's supposed to be.
But I think there's people who think that Judge Dredd is like the hero.
Yeah, they just don't see it. They're like, oh, he's the good guy, and he shoots the bad guys at the end.
Which I guess is kind of the same about, like, what we're talking about these stories that's so unexpected, is if you have that... If you're coming into a story with that level of kind of that being the surface level of what you want to understand, which is also a totally fine way to interact with media, as long as you're not attacking people for it afterwards because you don't understand. But if people are going into stories, oh, it's just this girl who's a ballerina. Oh, it's just like some weird girls comic. That's why you don't get these conversations of the depth, the class, why it's amazing to have a teen girls horror comic. You know, I still can't think of a contemporary version of that that's being published.
And I've got a question for you guys. I know, like, a lot of the keep politics out of comics, at least in the American version, tends to be from people who grew up on 90s comics, which was basically the lowest of the low valleys of comics in America, where they did basically get rid of everything that was interesting about the art form and basically...
added a lot of muscles.
Yeah, big muscles and big guns and small bikinis and big boobs and, you know, boom, boom, boom. That's all it was. It was freaking terrible, right? And so the people who read that and sort of imprinted there, they get upset because we've basically gone back to where we used to be. Because, you know, you have Kamala Khan, like you said, who's one of my absolute favorite comics. Ms. Marvel, also completely brilliant. And it's on the same level of social commentary that, you know, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams were doing with Green Arrow, Green Lantern back in the 70s. So, did you guys, did the Britain also go through their 90s phase? Is that where some...
Well, no, we just stopped doing comics.
The British 90s phase was the comics just went away.
Can we talk sport, humour, and more?
Well, I was just about to talk about humour, because if you come down to the 2008 booth, 2806, you will see copies of a book called Faceache, which is a favourite of mine. And I think it's particularly important because it's one of Alan Moore's favourite comics.
Which
is the way
before.
Yeah.
Anything that makes him happy.
Well, absolutely. And he actually wrote a foreword for the first in the collection of Faceache.
But can you not see the influence of Alan Moore when you read them?
Well, can we say what Faceache is? Can you explain what Faceache is for the crowd?
So, Faceache, he's the rubber-faced boy. The strip starts off with him being able to just gurn, so mould his face into like latex.
Sponges,
yeah. And it evolves quite quickly into him having a completely elastic body, so he can make himself into whatever he wants. And you go from fairly straightforward tales of him scaring the school janitor or something like that by having a funny face, all the way through to what is... I reread it again because it's so grotesque. It's basically, he's being bullied at school, and so he forms himself into the shape of an elephant to scare the school bully, who immediately goes and rats him out to the local zoo, who come and collect Faceache. And the last panel of this strip, this one-page strip, is basically being carted off to the zoo.
That's what it was like back then. You don't
well, that, absolutely, yeah. In the 70s, we used to put other people in zoos.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's absurdist and hilarious and just very, very... there were one-page strips, because... actually, we should say that British comics were all anthology comics, so it was all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 page stories, all round up next to each other in a 32-page issue. And so Face Ache would just be like one page, but the genius behind Face Ache is a man called Ken Reed. And it was amazing to us because the collection we've done at Face Ache is the first collection of Ken Reed's comics there has ever been. And as soon as we announced we were doing it, basically we had Dave Gibbons, Kevin O'Neill, Pat Mills, Alan Moore, everybody saying, oh my God, this is brilliant, this was the thing that made me want to do comics, this is why, this is, you know, and if you look at Kevin O'Neill's work on League or anything else, you can see that he, yeah, paid close attention to what Ken Reed was doing all the way through.
You can draw a line from Physics of Dearon Quinch.
Yep.
It's a direct line. Yeah. You can see exactly.
Dearon Quinch is, for those of you who don't know, an Alan Moore's fifth 2018, which is all about humour. All about humour and thermonuclear weapons.
But the grotesque humour is very present, I think, even in Moore's quote unquote serious work. And you can trace it all back to Basic.
But then you can see how that level of humour infects 2000 AD and the absurdity that everybody else is bringing to it as well. So and then that line goes through into the grotesque in different ways, but the kind of the ultra-ness of Mark Miller's tales and things like that, and brings you into modern American comics in many ways. So but it all kind of goes back to, in that weird way, of creators coming over in the 80s in Britain, but then the 80s British creators being influenced by 60s British creators. It goes back to Ken Reed and that he'd been lost. He'd been entirely forgotten.
Yeah, you hear an awful lot of stuff, not an awful lot of stuff, but if people are talking about cartoonists, they talk about Leo Baxendale, who worked for DC Thompson and was brilliant. But Ken Reed is easily his equal, if not, I'll be frank, and I don't mean to, I'm not denigrating.
It's not a competition between them, but he's probably better.
My favourite is Ken Reed, because there was that grotesqueness to it, was that harshness to it, which is hilarious in hindsight.
Well, I think one of the funniest things as well about Face Ache and any one-page British comic that is really often overlooked when it comes to impact. So anyone who knows or reads comics and stuff and ever reads people writing about them, they're always talking about, because of Alan Moore, right? Everyone's favourite cranky comics granddad. He made a certain format very popular, which is the 9-panel grid, right? And he made it so popular to the point where that's a sacred thing. If you split the page into 9 panels, can you use it? Can you utilize it properly? And I remember a few years ago, it's not included in the archives, but there's a great British comic, a Scottish comic called Orwellie and the Bruins, which were really seminal to me when I was growing up. And I was looking at the pages and I was like, oh my God, these are all 9 or 12 panel grids. And it's just the reason that they have this idea or that even the formatting gets in and impacts the way that people are laying out these comics. And something that was seen as this throwaway 2-penny comic, it actually has that formatting of this one page with multiple, with a grid with multiple panels, is now seen as the kind of highest end of how to lay out a modern comic. And I love that kind of, the way, you said, you can just draw it all back in, whether it's
formatting. It's a real statement. Tom King, Mrs. Miracle.
Oh, yeah.
People are like, oh my God, he's using the 9-panel grid, and the flicking to the archive, that's why everybody...
Yeah, it's
easy to read. All these comics weren't overthinking it. They were what will the most people be able to read?
It's lines, it's 3 lines. How do you read? Do you read like this?
And it's interesting that when you get the dawn of 2018, 1977, and to a certain or lesser extent, its predecessors, so Action Battle and Valiant and things like that, even kind of like Victor. I'm sorry, anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about. He's got not those family trees. There's hundreds and hundreds of these titles. Splash pages didn't exist.
No, because you...
Because that was a waste of storytelling opportunity.
Yeah. Your stories were 5 pages at most.
Yeah.
And 2018 was 5, I think, before that it was 3 pages. Mm. So it really was, how much story can we fit into these 3 pages? And the answer is, an exceptional amount. Yeah. More happens in a 3-page chapter of a Jinty story than happens in a 20-page novel.
Oh.
Mm.
I think one of the things that's really lost in this kind of archival comics, and what's nice about, you said, web comics can do it, is the fact that anthologies are really huge now with Kickstarter. Again, you get they know that this comic's going to be on the newsstand. You might only be able to pick up one. You're not necessarily going to pick up the next one. So you've got three pages, and in that is a complete story, or at least a story that if it has a cliffhanger, you're not going to cry if you can't get it. Whereas nowadays, a lot of comics, especially like 20 page of story, kind of big two comics, is all just to force the reader to keep reading. And sometimes not even with a cliffhanger, it's just like, here's half a story by the trade, here's core of a story, the trade has the full story, you know. So I love this kind of condensed idea of just, it's a complete story.
Yeah. What's great about the collections as well is recognize the rhythm. Because they have to introduce the concept, move the story forward, end the cliffhanger, every single three pages. And you adapt to that rhythm really quickly.
Wait, one of the things I really love about British humour comics, particularly things like Face Ache, and also Whizzer and Chips, which was one of the things I drove.
Were you a Whizzer or a Chip?
I was a Whiz kid.
Oh, we're at war. I was a Chip Ape.
There's a good example. So British comics like to set up conflict.
Yes.
Even within their own pages. So Whizzer and Chips is a single comic, but...
But it was
Chips is a small comic affixed to the Staples in the middle of Whizzer, and you were either a Whiz Kid or a Chip.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, 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 comic every exactly.
I mentioned the thing that I was going to talk about. With the one page human comics, quite often you have a banner across the top, which would be the title. All the information you needed about that character was contained within that. So for Face Ache, it's the Face Ache logo, and it says the rubber face boy or whatever it is. And that's it. And then you're expected to go into this world, and it works every single time. So all of the characters, even the DC Thompson stuff, like, you know, Mini Mix, Dead Snacks, and whatnot, all the information is there, and you can pick the comic up and immediately start reading, because one of the elements, and it's nice that we've come onto this, because as we're coming towards the end of the panel, I want to talk about the things that modern comics can learn from this archive is, as you say, you've got one chance to hook the reader. You're not necessarily trying to fix them into an ecosystem that keeps them reading and reading and reading.
Yeah.
You want them to read that comic and enjoy it, so and for them to get an experience out of it, so that next week they will pick the next one up and the next one. And it may be formulaic, so as, you know, when we're putting together collections, we're very conscious that sometimes these scripts can be the same joke every single week, and when you're reading them in big 100-page collections, that can, you know, can be difficult. But there's so much about the pleasure it gives the reader. The reader is the most important person in that transaction.
Yeah.
Whereas so many comics seem to be actually about the publisher.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much that comics today can learn from these comics. The economy of storytelling is definitely one of them. The idea that everyone deserves a story, both in terms of the reader, every sort of reader deserves a story, but every sort of character deserves a story. You know, the breadth of stories being told in these comics is far beyond anything that's in the American market right now, apart from the translated manga. I mean, these comics, the British comics of the 70s and 80s, are manga.
In fact, one of the perfect examples is a sports comic, which
there's loads of sports manga.
Like right now in manga, as I often tell people, it's like if you're in the American manga, we get like maybe 1/1,000,000th of the amount of comics that are actually released on it every day in Japan. Like literally, I mean it's insane. And there is a comic for absolutely every single person in the country. Whatever your hobby is. Are you a gardener? Here's 10 comics about gardening, you know? Do you like
curling?
Yeah, curling. Here's some comics about curling. Are you a figure skating fan? Here's 15 comics for you. I mean, it really doesn't matter. They will target the most minuscule hobby, and then they will have a comic. Cooking comics are phenomenal. Oh, yeah. God, they have great cooking comics over here.
I think that one of the things, if we're talking about like what you can learn, is like it's the idea of having stories. Like you can do a sports comic, and it doesn't just have to be. And there's nothing wrong with like sports strips or wholly focused just on the game of football. But what manga and what these kind of 70s archival comics are, you can have a story that's centered on like a sport or something, but it can really be about the people in the story. It's about using different experiences as backgrounds or jumping off points for creating a story?
What they do is, one of the things I think we fundamentally talk about is connecting with audiences, and so one major part of the archive that we haven't released as a collection yet is Roy the Rovers. So Roy the Rovers is 65 years young next year. He is a... he's gone so far beyond the pages of comics, he's in the soccer football lexicon now. Real Roy the Rovers story is constantly mentioned, at least in the British media, but also internationally in the commentary on the recent World Cup. And basically, Roy the Rovers is a footballer, he plays for Melchester Rovers, and he is the embodiment of fair play and team spirit. And he was eternally popular, and what we have discovered... Because we were the publishers in 2008, and we like the sci-fi and the action and the rest of it, and possibly I think it's fair to say that with the exception of a couple of people, largely we weren't the sporty kids in school. But the sporty kids still needed to read. And the thing is, what we've discovered since becoming the managers of Roy the Rovers is that Roy was the route into literacy for generations and generations of men, and really interestingly, sports journalists, almost exclusively in the UK, if they're over the age of 35, were kind of turned on to reading by Roy the Rovers and a football strip, and a strip that was about, if they weren't going to read anything, they'd be given... they'd be bought for 7p, the Tiger or the Rovers comic, and because it was short 5-page stories, there's not an obligation to read the whole thing in one sitting. No, you read your 5 pages and you're done, and you come back to it later, whatever. And that way of bringing reluctant readers into literacy was a huge deal, and I think it got taken for granted at the time, and then it was lost.
It does.
Comics were ubiquitous. They really were.
Yeah, and also as well, that's like one of so many of us say it. I'm pretty sure every single one of us has said it. Most of you in this room have probably said it. We talk about it all the time. Like, comics are such a great way of getting people to read. They're such an accessible, fantastic way, whether it's a young person who doesn't really like reading or an older person who never really got the chance to learn. Like, there are so many incredible stories, and it's like you said, it's an open kind of channel. Like, if you're not that comfortable with literacy, you can look at the pictures, and if you like it enough, maybe you're going to want to kind of understand the words. But for so long, it's been seen as this secondary media. I mean, we were them, blah blah blah, not to go on that, but like, there was a time when they were saying that comics rotted your brain and they were dangerous, and that kind of legacy led to the positives of something like Roy the Rovers being overlooked, because so many people were either like, it's trash, it's worse for you than not reading. And so many other people were just like, oh, it's a comic.
But this thing, everybody read comics and then transitioned to real books and the rest of it. But there was that thing where everybody got handed a comic. But certainly in Britain, when the 90s came and they stopped making comics, to a large extent, certainly stopped making comics for children, that generation was wiped out. It's only been through manga, actually, that the whole younger generations have got back into comics and the rest of it.
Yeah.
So we have this weird with the comic. But we seem to be... getting back to the same place where it was what you were saying, is that with a diversity of subject matter, and this is what we see with Roy the Rovers and with the girls' comics and the sport and the sci-fi comics, and the war comics, and the humor comics, that as long as there's something for you to read, there are a lot of readers there, but it's just having enough different subject matter available and where to go and to find it.
Well, that's like in the US, one of the worst things that happened in the U.S. was we lost our marketplace, right? Everything went to the direct market, so you had to go to a comic shop to buy a comic. You had to live in a town that had a comic shop that was accessible enough, where before they were, I grew up getting comics at the 7-Eleven. I had the grocery store where my mom took me shopping. It was always, if I was a good boy, I'd get a few comics, so I made sure to be a good boy because I wanted those comics. But we lost that, and for a lot of people thought that, comics is a dying medium, right? Oh, we are saying goodbye to comics. Like everyone always says over here, they call it Comic-Con, but everyone's really going for the movies, But then all you have to do is look them in the eye and whisper the name Renee, Helgemeyer, And a number of people who say, I love comics, but don't know who she is, floors me. It's like, the best-selling comic book artist in the world, and you just don't happen. She's a blind spot,
In case you don't know Raina, she's a woman cartoonist who makes middle grade YA original graphic novels for kids. She did Babysitter's Club, an adaptation which was a huge best-selling. She did Smile, Ghosts, a bunch of others. But there were times when the New York Times still had a graphic novels bestseller list, she would regularly have 5 or 6 books.
She was like the top 5 forever. And she did it by not listening to everyone. She just basically, she's like, oh, you're saying that, you know, young girls don't read comics? She sold through Scholastic, so she's selling directly to them at schools. So she's like, the market is there. But you know where they're not? They're not going to comic shops.
Yeah.
They're not going to these comic shops that make a lot of female customers feel unwelcome and uncomfortable. You know, they just went to them.
There's like 1,500 comic shops in the whole of North America, so you don't, it's not like every Target you go to will have Rainer books, and there's obviously more Targets. Also, another thing I guess, about the learning and stuff is the idea that like, that you can make something that people tell you you shouldn't make, which is definitely what British comics did. It's definitely what 2000 AD did. And when you said that about Rainer, it makes so much sense, because like another incredible creator who's also a publisher, C. Spike Trotman.
I was just about to say that, yep.
She has raised over $1 million through Kickstarter for books that people said no one would ever read, heroic kind of comics, monster comics, comics by black creators, comics for black women, comics for trans people. Like, she made all these books and people want them because there is this audience, and she's made millions of over $1 million. And now, you know, publishers are trying to, you'll notice that a lot of the big publishers in the markets will be copying her, the same way I think that got misconstrued in a lot of the Western American mainstream 90s comics, talk about the ultra violence, and a lot of people were trying to cape the Judge Dredd, the macho, the kind of, you can't see the face, it's this kind of hero. But they didn't understand that Judge Dredd was a satire of that before its time. You know?
Well, that's like Alan Moore famously with Rorschach. He's like, you're not supposed to like Rorschach. Yeah,
well,
you know?
The most horrible.
Yeah.
but yeah, we've just got to wrap things up now. I think my last point is that talking about Wizard and Chips, I would like to see the return of comic book fan clubs.
Yes.
Every comic book had a fan club.
With a card.
You got a little card. And maybe a little pin badge. And the reason I started reading 2000 AD is because 2000 AD used to do the best of 2000 AD monthly, which was like a monthly reprint title. It was a really cheap and easy way, before graphic novels, to get read all the classics. First one I picked up was a series called The VCs by Jerry Finley Day, Mick McMahon, and, Cam Kennedy, and whatnot. And on the front cover, it said, join the VCs, vape a space invader today. And I thought there was a club I could join. I wanted to be a VC. So I'm all for the return.
Every day you're vaping space invader.
Yeah. But I'm great. This has been absolutely fantastic. We could go for another hour. I don't know if you want to listen to us for another hour.
I wanted to say one more thing to just apply. As someone who has absolutely no nostalgia or attachment to these comics and was sent them to read just for this panel, they are good comics, and you should totally check them out. I thoroughly enjoyed every single one I read, so go to the booth and give them a read.
For people who know 2080, there are so many 2080 creators who created these comics. If you like Pat Mills, if you like John Wagner, if you like Alan Moore, you know, their work is in this. There really is a lost archive.
And they are available from booth 2806 on the show floor. That's all we've got time for, so a huge round of applause for our panel.
I hope you enjoyed that, Earthlets. It was a fascinating listen for me again as well to hear the different opinions on the stuff that Treasury of British Comics has got out there at the moment, but also the stuff that's going to be coming up. Really exciting times for 2080 and Rebellion Publishing. Now, don't forget to spread the word about the Galaxy's Greatest podcast as we continue our San Diego coverage. Do make sure you subscribe to the Thrillcast on iTunes or your preferred podcast supplier. Also, spread the word on social media, if you would be so kind. And if you have a moment, we would really appreciate you leaving a star review and maybe a few words on our iTunes page, as it helps game the algorithm and spread the word to other Earthlets out there. Well, thanks to all the Squawks Deck Thargo for listening to another edition of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Until next time, Splundig Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Thrill power levels dangerously high.
Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.